He had actually brooded over his loss until he had reached the point at which he was contemplating suicide. After he had finished his story, I said to him, "I have listened to you with a great deal of interest, and I wish that there was something which I could do to help you, but there is absolutely nothing." He became as pale as he will be said when he's laid away in a coffin, and settled back in his chair and dropped his chin on his chest, as much as to say, "That settles it." I waited for a few seconds, then said, "While there is nothing that I can do for you, there is a man in this building, to whom I will introduce you, if you wish, who can help you regain your lost fortune and put you back on your feet again." These words had barely fallen from my lips when he jumped up, grabbed me by the hands, and said, "For God's sake, lead me to this man." It was encouraging to note that he had asked this for God's sake. This indicated that there was still a spark of hope within his breast. So I took him by the arm and led him out into the laboratory where my psychological tests and character analysis were conducted, and stood with him in front of what looked to be a curtain over a door. I pulled the curtain aside and uncovered a tall looking glass in which he saw himself from head to foot. Pointing my finger at the glass, I said, "There stands the man to whom I promised to introduce you. There is the only man in this world who can put you back on your feet again. And unless you sit down and become acquainted with that man, as you never became acquainted with him before, you might just as well go on over and punch a hole in Lake Michigan, because you will be of no value to yourself or to the world until you know this man better." He stepped over to the glass, rubbed his hands over his bearded face, studied himself from head to foot for a few moments, then stepped back, dropped his head, and began to weep. I knew that the lesson had been driven home. So I led him back to the elevator and sent him away. I never expected to see him again, and I doubted that the lesson would be sufficient to help him regain his place in the world, because he seemed to be too far gone for redemption. He seemed to be not only down, but almost out. A few days later, I met this man on the street. His transformation had been so complete that I hardly recognized him. He was walking briskly with his head tilted back. That old, shifting, nervous posture of his body was gone. He was dressed in new clothes from head to foot. He looked prosperous, and he felt prosperous. He stopped me and related what had happened to bring about this rapid transformation from a state of abject failure to one of hope and promise. "I was just on my way to your office," he explained, "to bring you the good news. I went out that very day, and I was in your office a down-and-out tramp, and despite my appearance, I sold myself at a salary of $3,000 a year. Think of it, man, $3,000 a year. And my employer advanced me money enough with which to buy some new clothes. And as you can see for yourself, he also advanced me some money to send home to my family, and I'm once more on the road to success. It seems like a dream when I think that only a few days ago I had lost hope and faith and courage and was actually contemplating suicide. I was coming to tell you that one of these days, when you are at least expecting me, I will pay you another visit, and when I do, I will be a successful man. I will bring with me a check, signed in blank and payable to you, and you may fill in the amount because you have saved me from myself, by introducing me to myself, that self which I never knew until you stood me in front of that looking glass and pointed out the real me." As that man turned and departed in the crowded streets of Chicago, I saw, for the first time in my life, what strength and power and possibility lie hidden in the mind of the man who has never discovered the value of self-reliance. Then and there, I made up my mind that I, too, would stand in front of that same looking-glass and point an accusing finger at myself for not having discovered the lesson which I had helped another to learn. I did stand before that same looking-glass, and as I did so, I then and there fixed in my mind, as my definite purpose in life, the determination to help men and women discover the forces that lie sleeping within them. The book you hold in your hands is evidence that my definite purpose is being carried out. The man whose story I have related is now the president of one of the largest and most successful concerns of its kind in America. With a business that extends from coast to coast and from Canada to Mexico. A short while after the incident just related, a woman came to my office for personal analysis. She was then a teacher in the Chicago public schools. I gave her an analysis chart and asked her to fill it out. She had been at work on that chart but a few minutes when she came back to my desk, handed back the chart and said, "I do not believe I will fill this out." I asked her why she decided not to fill out the chart, and she replied, "To be perfectly frank with you, one of the questions in this chart put me to thinking, and I now know what is wrong with me. Therefore, I feel it unnecessary to pay you a fee to analyze me." With that, the woman went away, and I did not hear from her for 2 years. She went to New York City, became a writer of advertising copy for one of the largest agencies in the country, and her income at the time she wrote me was $10,000 a year. This woman sent me a check to cover the cost of my analysis fee, because she felt that the fee had been earned, even though I did not render her the service that I usually render my clients. It is impossible for anyone to foretell what seemingly insignificant incident may lead to an important turning point in one's career. But there is no denying the fact that these turning points may be more readily recognized by those who have well-rounded out confidence in themselves. One of the irreparable losses to the human race lies in the lack of knowledge that there is a definite method through which self-confidence can be developed in any person or average intelligence. What an immeasurable loss to civilization that young men and women are not taught this known method of developing self-confidence before they complete their schooling. For no one who lacks faith in himself is really educated in the proper sense of the term. Oh, what glory and satisfaction would be the happy heritage of the man or woman who could pull aside the curtain of fear that hangs over the human race and shuts out the sunlight of understanding that self-confidence brings, wherever it is in evidence. Where fear controls, noteworthy achievement becomes an impossibility, a fact which brings to mind the definition of fear, as stated by a great philosopher. Fear is the dungeon of the mind into which it runs and hides and seeks seclusion. Fear brings on superstition, and superstition is the dagger with which hypocrisy assassinates the soul. In front of the typewriter, on which I am now writing the manuscripts of this reading course, hangs a sign with the following wording in big letters. Day by day, in every way, I am becoming more successful. A skeptic who read that sign asked if I really believed that stuff, and I replied, "Of course not. All it ever did for me was to help me to get out of the coal mines, where I started as a laborer, and find a place in the world in which I am serving upwards of 100,000 people, in whose mind I am planting the same positive thought that this sign brings out. Therefore, why should I believe in it?" As this man started to leave, he said, "Well, perhaps there is something to this sort of philosophy after all, for I have always been afraid that I would be a failure, and so far my fears have been thoroughly realized." You are condemning yourself to poverty, misery, and failure, or you are driving yourself on towards the heights of great achievement solely by the thoughts you think. If you demand success of yourself, and back up this demand with intelligent action, you are sure to win. Bear in mind, though, that there is a difference between demanding success and just merely wishing for it. You should find out what this difference is and take advantage of it. Do you remember what the Bible says? Look it up somewhere in the book of Matthew about those who have faith as a grain of a mustard seed. Go at the task of developing self-confidence with at least that much faith, if not more. Never mind what they will say, because you might as well know that they will be of little aid to you in your climb up the mountainside of life towards the object of your definite purpose. You have within you all the power you need with which to get whatever you want or need in this world, and about the best way to avail yourself of this power is to believe in yourself. Know thyself, man. Know thyself. This has been the advice of the philosophers all down the ages. When you really know yourself, you will know that there is nothing foolish about hanging a sign in front of you that reads like this: day by day, in every way, I am becoming more successful. With due apologies to the Frenchman who made this motto popular, I am not afraid to place this sort of suggestion in front of my desk. And what is more to the point, I am not afraid to believe that it will influence me so that I will become a more positive and aggressive human being. More than 25 years ago, I learned my first lesson in self-confidence building. One night I was sitting before an open fireplace, listening to a conversation between some older men on the subject of capital and labor. Without invitation, I joined in the conversation and said something about employers and employees settling their differences on the golden rule basis. My remarks attracted the attention of one of the men, who turned to me with a look of surprise on his face and said, "Why, you are a bright boy, and if you would go out and get a schooling, you would make your mark in the world." Those remarks fell on fertile ears, even though that was the first time anyone had ever told me that I was bright, or that I might accomplish anything worthwhile in life. The remark put me into thinking, and the more I allowed my mind to dwell upon the thought, the more certain I became that the remark had back of it a possibility. It might be truthfully stated that whatever service I am rendering the world and whatever good I accomplished should be credited to that offhand remark. Suggestions such as this are often powerful, and nonetheless so when they are deliberate and self-expressed. Go back now to the self-confidence formula and master it, for it will lead you into the powerhouse of your own mind, where you will tap a force that can be made to carry you to the very top of the ladder of success. Others will believe in you only when you believe in yourself. They will tune in on your thoughts and feel toward you just as you feel toward yourself. The law of mental telepathy takes care of this. You are continuously broadcasting what you think of yourself. And if you have no faith in yourself, others will pick up the vibration of your thought and mistake them for your own. Once understood the law of mental telepathy, and you will know why self-confidence is a second of the 15 laws of success. You should be cautioned, however, to learn the difference between self-confidence, which is based upon self-knowledge of what you know and what you can do, and egotism, which is only based upon what you wish you knew or could do. Learn the difference between these two terms, or you will make yourself boresome, ridiculous, and annoying to people of culture and understanding. Self-confidence is something which should never be proclaimed or announced, except through intelligence performance of constructive deeds. If you have self-confidence, those around you will discover this fact. Let them make the discovery. They will feel proud of their alertness in having made the discovery, and you will be free from the suspicion of egotism. Opportunity never stalks the person with a highly developed state of egotism, but brickbats and ugly remarks do. Opportunity forms affinities much more easily and quickly with self-confidence than it does with egotism. Self-praise is never a proper measure of self-reliance. Bear this in mind and let your self-confidence speak only through the tongue of constructive service rendered without fuss or flurry. Self-confidence is the product of knowledge. Know yourself. Know how much you know and how little, why you know it, and how you are going to use it. Four flushers come to grief, therefore, do not pretend to know more than you actually do know. There's no use of pretense, because any educated person will measure you quite accurately after hearing you speak for 3 minutes. What you really are will speak so loudly that what you claim you are will not be heard. If you heed this warning, the last four pages of this one lesson may mark one of the most important turning points of your life. Believe it yourself, but do not tell the world what you can do. Show it. You are now ready for lesson 4, which will take you to the next step up the ladder of success. Discontentment, an after-the-lesson visit with the author. The marker stands at the entrance gate of life and writes "poor fool" on the brow of the wise man, and "poor sinner" on the brow of the saint. The supreme mystery of the universe's life, we come here without our consent, from whence we know not. We go away without our consent, whither we know not. We are eternally trying to solve this great riddle of life, and for what purpose and to what end? That we are placed on this earth for a definite reason, there can be no doubt by any thinker. May it not be possible that the power which placed us here will know what to do with us when we pass on beyond the great divide? Would it not be a good plan to give the Creator who placed us here on earth credit for having enough intelligence to know what to do with us after we pass on? Or should we assume the intelligence and the ability to control the future life in our own way? May it not be possible that we can cooperate with the Creator very intelligently by assuming to control our conduct on this earth to the end that we may be decent to one another and do all the good we can in all the ways we can during this life, leaving the hereafter to one who probably knows better than we what is best for us? The artist has told a powerful story in the picture at the top of the page. From the birth until death, the mind is always reaching out for that which it does not possess. The little child, playing with its toys on the floor, sees another child with a different sort of toy, and immediately tries to lay hands on that toy. The female child, grown tall, believes the other woman's clothes more becoming than her own, and sets out to duplicate them. The male child, grown tall, sees another man with a bigger collection of railroads or banks or merchandise, and says to himself, "How fortunate, how fortunate! How can I separate him from his belongings?" F. W. Woolworth, the 5- and 10-cent store king, stood on Fifth Avenue in New York City and gazed upward at the tall Metropolitan Building and said, "How wonderful! I will build one much taller." The crowning achievement of his life was measured by the Woolworth Building. That building stands as a temporary symbol of a man's nature to excel the handiwork of other men, a monument to the vanity of man, with but little else to justify its existence. The little ragged newsboy on the street stands with wide-open mouth and envies the businessman as he alights from his automobile at the curb and starts into his office. "How happy I would be," the newsboy says to himself, "if I owned a Lizzie." And the businessman seated at the desk inside thinks how happy he would be if he could add another $1 million to his already overswollen bank account. "The grass is always sweeter on the other side of the fence," says the jackass, as he stretches his neck in the attempt to get to it. Turn a crowd of boys into an apple orchard, and they will pass by the nice mellow apples on the ground. The red juicy ones, hanging dangerously high in the top of the tree, look much more tempting, and up the tree they will go. The married man takes a sheepish glance at the dauntily dressed ladies on the street, and thinks how fortunate he would be if his wife were as pretty as they. Perhaps she is much prettier, but he misses that beauty because, well, because the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. Most divorce cases grow out of man's tendency to climb the fence into the other fellow's pasture. Happiness is always just around the bend, always in sight but just out of reach. Life is never complete, no matter what we have or how much of it we possess. One thing calls for something else to go with it. Milady buys a pretty hat. She must have a gown to match it. That calls for new shoes and hose and gloves and other accessories that run into a big bill far beyond her husband's means. Man longs for a home, just a plain little house setting off in the edge of the woods. He builds it, but it is not complete. He must have shrubbery and flowers and landscaping to go with it. Still, it is not complete. He must have a beautiful fence around it with a gravel driveway. That calls for a motor car and a garage in which to house it. All these little touches have been added, but to no avail. The place is now too small. He must have a house with more rooms. The Ford coupe must be replaced by a Cadillac sedan, so there will be room for company in the cross-country tours. On and on the story goes ad infinitum. The young man receives a salary sufficient to keep him and his family fairly comfortable. Then comes a promotion and an advance in salary of $1,000 a year. Does he lay the extra $1,000 away in the savings account and continue living as before? He does nothing of the sort. Immediately he must trade the old car in for a new one. A porch must be added to the house. The wife needs a new wardrobe. The table must be set with better food and more of it. Pity his poor, groaning stomach. At the end of the year, is he better off with the increase? He is nothing of the sort. The more he gets, the more he wants. And the rule applies to the man with millions the same as to the man with but a few thousand. The young man selects the girl of his choice, believing he cannot live without her. After he gets her, he is not sure that he can live with her. If a man remains a bachelor, he wonders why he is so stupid as to deprive himself of the joys of married life. If he marries, he wonders how she happened to catch him off guard long enough to harpoon him. And the god of destiny cries out, "Oh fool, oh fool, you are damned if you do and you are damned if you don't." At every crossroad of life, the imps of discontentment stand in the shadows of the background, with a grin of mockery on their face, crying out, "Take the road of your own choice. We will get you in the end." At last, man becomes disillusioned and begins to learn that happiness and contentment are not of this world. Then begins the search for the password that will open a door to him in some world of which he knows not. Surely there must be happiness on the other side of the great divide. In desperation, his tired, care-worn heart turns to religion for hope and encouragement. But his troubles are not over. They are just beginning. "Come into our tent and accept our creed," says one sect, "and you may go straight to heaven after death." Poor man hesitates, looks and listens. Then he hears the call of another brand of religion whose leader says, "Stay out of the other camp or you'll go straight to hell. They only sprinkle water on your head, but we push you all the way under, thereby ensuring your safe passage into the land of promise." In the midst of sectarian claims and counterclaims, poor man becomes undecided, not knowing whether to turn this way or that. He wonders which religion offers the safest passageway until hope vanishes. "Myself, when young, did eagerly frequent doctor and saint and heard great argument about it and about, but evermore came out by the same door wherein I went. Always seeking, but never finding." Thus might be described man's struggle for happiness and contentment. He tries one religion after another, finally joining the big church, which the world has named the damned. His mind becomes an eternal question mark, searching hither and yon for an answer to the question, whence and whither. The worldly hope men set their hearts upon turns ashes o'er its prospers and anon, like snow upon the desert's dusty face, lightning a little hour or two is gone. Life is an everlasting question mark. That which we want most is always in the embryonic distance of the future. Our power to acquire is always a decade or so behind our power to desire. And if we catch up with the thing we want, we no longer want it. Fortunate is the young woman who learns this great truth and keeps her lover always guessing, always on the defensive, lest he may lose her. Our favorite author is a hero and a genius until we meet him in person and learn the sad truth that, after all, he is only a man. How often must we learn this lesson? Men cease to interest us when we find their limitation. The only sin is limitation. As soon as you once come up with a man's limitation, it is all over with him. Emerson. How beautiful the mountain yonder in the distance. But the moment we draw near it, we find it to be nothing but a wretched collection of rocks, dirt, and trees. Out of this truth grew the oft-repeated adage, familiarity breeds contempt. Beauty and happiness and contentment are states of mind. They can never be enjoyed except through vision of the afar. The most beautiful painting of Rembrandt becomes a mere smudge of dabbed paint if we come too near it. Destroy the hope of unfinished dreams in man's heart and he is finished. The moment a man ceases to cherish the vision of future achievement, he is through. Nature has built man so that his greatest and only lasting happiness is that which he feels in the pursuit of some yet unattained object. Anticipation is sweeter than realization. That which is at hand does not satisfy. The only enduring satisfaction is that which comes to the person who keeps alive in his heart the hope of future achievement. When that hope dies, writes Fini, across the human heart. Life's greatest inconsistency is the fact that most of that which we believe is not true. Russell Conwell wrote the most popular lecture ever delivered in the English language. He called it Acres of Diamonds. The central idea of the lecture was a statement that one need not seek opportunity in the distance, that opportunity may be found in the vicinity of one's birth. Perhaps, but how many believe it? Opportunity may be found wherever one really looks for it, and nowhere else. To most men, the picking looks better on the other side of the fence. How futile to urge one to try one's luck in the little hometown when it is man's nature to look for opportunity in some other locality. Do not worry because the grass looks sweeter on the other side of the fence. Nature intended it so. Thus does she allure us and groom us for the lifelong task of growth through struggle. End of Lesson 3. The Law of Success, Lesson 4, The Habit of Saving. Man is a combination of flesh, bone, blood, hair, and brain cells. These are the building materials out of which he shapes, through the law of habit, his own personality. To advise one to save money without describing how to save would be somewhat like drawing the picture of a horse and writing under it, "This is a horse." It is obvious to all that the saving of money is one of the essentials for success, but the big question uppermost in the minds of the majority of those who do not save is, how can I do it? The saving of money is solely a matter of habit. For this reason, this lesson begins with a brief analysis of the law of habit. It is literally true that man, through the law of habit, shapes his own personality. Through repetition, any act indulged in a few times becomes a habit, and the mind appears to be nothing more than a mass of motivating forces growing out of our daily habits. When one fixed in the mind a habit voluntarily impels one to action, for example, follow a given route to your daily work, or to some other place that you frequently visit, and very soon the habit has been formed, and your mind will lead you over the route without thought on your part. Moreover, if you start out with the intention of traveling in another direction, without keeping the thought of the change in routes constantly in mind, you will find yourself following the old route. Public speakers have found that the telling over and over again of a story, which may be based upon pure fiction, brings into play the law of habit, and very soon they forget whether the story is true or not. Walls of limitation built through habit. Millions of people go through life in poverty and want because they have made destructive use of the law of habit. Not understanding either the law of habit or the law of attraction through which like attracts like, those who remain in poverty seldom realize that they are where they are as a result of their own act. Fix in your mind the thought that your ability is limited to a given earning capacity, and you will never earn more than that. Because the law of habit will set up a definite limitation of the amount you can earn. Your subconscious mind will accept this limitation, and very soon you will feel yourself slipping, until finally you will become so hedged in by your fear of poverty, which is one of the six basic fears, that opportunity will no longer knock at your door. Your doom will be sealed, your fate fixed. Formation of the habit of saving does not mean that you shall limit your earning capacity. It means just the opposite, that you shall apply this law so that it not only conserves that which you earn in a systematic manner, but it also places you in the way of a greater opportunity and gives you the vision, the self-confidence, the imagination, the enthusiasm, the initiative and leadership actually to increase your earning capacity. Stating this great law in another way, when you thoroughly understand the law of habit, you may ensure yourself success in the great game of money-making by playing both ends of that game against the middle. You proceed in this manner. First, through the law of definite chief aim, you set up in your mind an accurate, definite description of that which you want, including the amount of money you intend to earn. Your subconscious mind takes over this picture, which you have created, and uses it as a blueprint, chart, or map by which to mold your thoughts and actions into practical plans for attaining the object of your chief aim or purpose. Through the law of habit, you keep the object of your definite chief aim fixed in your mind, in the manner described in Lesson 2, until it becomes firmly and permanently implanted there. This practice will destroy the poverty conscious and set up in its place a prosperity consciousness. You will actually begin to demand prosperity. You will begin to expect it. You will begin to prepare yourself to receive it and to use it wisely, thus paving the way or setting the stage for the development of the habit of saving. Secondly, having in this manner increased your earning power, you will make further use of the law of habit by provision in your written statement of your chief definite aim for saving a definite proportion of all the money you earn. Therefore, as your earning increases, your savings will, likewise, increase in proportion. By ever urging yourself on and demanding of yourself increased earning power on the one hand, and by systematically laying aside a definite amount of all your earnings on the other hand, you will soon reach the point at which you have removed all imaginary limitations from your own mind, and you will then be well started on the road towards financial independence. Nothing could be more practical or more easily accomplished than this. Reverse the operation of the law of habit by setting up in your mind the fear of poverty, and very soon this fear will reduce your earning capacity until you will be barely able to earn sufficient money to take care of your actual necessities. The publishers of newspapers could create a panic in a week's time by filling their columns with news items concerning the actual business failures of the country. Despite the fact that but few businesses compared to the total number in existence actually failed, the so-called crime waves are very largely the products of sensational journalism. A single murder case, when exploited by the headlines of the country through scare headlines, is sufficient to start a regular wave of similar crimes in various localities. Following the repetition in the daily papers of the Hickman murder story, similar cases began to be reported from other parts of the country. We are the victims of our habits, no matter who we are or what may be our life calling. Any idea that is deliberately fixed in the mind, or any idea that is permitted to sit itself in the mind as a result of suggestion, environment, the influence of associates, etc., is sure to cause us to indulge in acts which conform to the nature of the idea. Form the habit of thinking and talking of prosperity and abundance, and very soon material evidence of these will begin to manifest itself in the nature of wider opportunity and new and unexpected opportunity. Like attracts like. If you are in business and have formed the habit of talking and thinking about business being bad, business will be bad. One pessimist, providing he is permitted to continue his destructive influence long enough, can destroy the work of a half a dozen competent men, and he will do it by setting adrift in the minds of his associates the thought of poverty and failure. Don't be this type of man or woman. One of the most successful bankers in the state of Illinois has this sign hanging in his private office. We talk and think only of abundance here. If you have a tale of woe, please keep it, as we do not want it. No business firm wants the services of a pessimist, and those who understand the law of attraction and the law of habit will no more tolerate the pessimist than they would permit a burglar to roam around their place of business, for the reason that one such person will destroy the usefulness of those around him. In tens of thousands of homes, the general topic of conversation is poverty and want, and that is just what they are getting. They think of poverty. They talk of poverty. They accept poverty as their lot in life. They reason that because their ancestors were poor before them, they also must remain poor. The poverty consciousness is formed as the result of the habit of thinking of and fearing poverty. Lo, the thing I feared has come upon me. The slavery of debt. Debt is a merciless master, a fatal enemy of the saving habit. Poverty alone is sufficient to kill off ambition, destroy self-confidence, and destroy hope. But add to it the burden of debt, and all who are victims of these two cruel taskmasters are practically doomed to failure. No man can do his best work. No man can express himself in terms that command respect. No man can either create or carry out a definite purpose in life with heavy debt hanging over his head. The man who is bound in the slavery of debt is just as helpless as the slave who is bound by ignorance or by actual chains. The author has a very close friend whose income is $1,000 a month. His wife loves society and tries to make a $20,000 showing on a $12,000 income, with the result that this poor fella is usually about $8,000 in debt. Every member of his family has the spending habit, having acquired this from the mother. The children, two girls and one boy, are now at the age when they are thinking of going to college. But this is impossible because of the father's debt. The result is dissension between the family and his children, which makes the entire family unhappy and miserable. It is a terrible thing even to think of going through life like a prisoner in chains, bound down and owned by somebody else on account of debts. The accumulation of debts is a habit. It starts in a small way and grows to enormous proportions slowly, step by step, until finally it takes charge of one's very own soul. Thousands of young men start their married lives with unnecessary debts hanging over their heads and never manage to get out from under the load. After the novelty of marriage begins to wear off, as it usually does, the married couple begin to feel the embarrassment of want, and this feeling grows until it leads oftentimes to open dissatisfaction with one another, and eventually to the divorce court. A man who is bound by the slavery of debt has no time or inclination to set up or work out ideals, with the result that he drifts downward with time, until he eventually begins to set up limitations in his own mind. And by these he hedges himself behind prison walls of fear and doubt from which he can never escape. No sacrifice is too great to avoid the misery of debt. Think of what you owe yourself and those who are dependent upon you, and resolve to be no man's debtor, is the advice of one very successful man whose early chances were destroyed by debt. This man came to himself soon enough to throw off the habit of buying that which he did not need, and eventually worked his way out of slavery. Most men who develop the habit of debt will not be so fortunate as to come to their senses in time to save themselves. Because debt is something like quicksand, in that it has a tendency to draw its victim deeper and deeper into the mire. The fear of poverty is one of the most destructive of the six basic fears described in Lesson 3. The man who becomes hopelessly in debt is seized with this poverty fear. His ambition and self-confidence become paralyzed, and he sinks gradually into oblivion. There are two classes of debts, and these are so different in nature that they deserve to be here described as follows. 1. There are debts incurred for luxuries which become a dead loss. 2. There are debts incurred in the course of professional or business trading which represent service or merchandise that can be converted back into assets. The first class of debts is the one to be avoided. The second class may be indulged in, providing the one incurring the debts uses judgment and does not go beyond the bounds of reasonable limitation. The moment one buys beyond his limitation, he enters the realm of speculation, and speculation swallows more of its victim than it enriches. Practically all people who live beyond their means are tempted to speculate with the hope that they may recoup, at a single turn of a wheel of fortune, so to speak, their entire indebtedness. The wheel generally stops at the wrong place, and far from finding themselves out of debt, some people indulged in speculation are bound more closely as slaves of debt. The fear of poverty breaks down the willpower of its victim, and they then find themselves unable to restore their lost fortunes. And what is still more sad, they lose all ambition to extricate themselves from the slavery of debt. Hardly a day passes that one may not see an account in a newspaper of at least one suicide as the result of worry over debts. The slavery of debt causes more suicides every year than all other causes combined, which is a slight indication of the cruelty of the poverty fear. During the war, millions of men faced the frontline trenches without flinching, knowing that death might overtake them at any moment. Those same men, when facing the fear of poverty, often cringe and, out of sheer desperation, which paralyzes their reason, sometimes commit suicide. The person who is free from debt may whip poverty and achieve outstanding financial success, but if he is bound by debt, such achievement is but a remote possibility and never a probability. Fear of poverty is a negative, destructive state of mind. Moreover, one negative state of mind has a tendency to attract other similar states of mind. For example, the fear of poverty may attract the fear of ill health, and these two may attract the fear of old age, so that the victim finds himself poverty-stricken, in ill health, and actually growing old long before the time when he should begin to show the signs of old age. Millions of untimely, nameless graves have been filled by this cruel state of mind known as the fear of poverty. Less than a dozen years ago, a young man held a responsible position with the City National Bank of New York. Through living beyond his income, he contracted a large amount of debt, which caused him to worry until this destructive habit began to show up in his work and he was dismissed from the bank's service. He secured another position at less money, but his creditors embarrassed him so that he decided to resign and go away into another city, where he hoped to escape them until he had accumulated enough money to pay off his indebtedness. Creditors have a way of tracing debtors, so very soon they were close on his heels with this young man, whose employer found out about his indebtedness and dismissed him from his position. He then searched in vain for employment for 2 months. One cold night, he went to the top of one of the tall buildings on Broadway and jumped off. Debt again had claimed another victim. How to master the fear of poverty? To whip the fear of poverty, one must take 2 very definite steps. Providing one is in debt, first, quit the habit of buying on credit, and follow this by gradually paying off the debts that you have already incurred. Being free from the worry of indebtedness, you are ready to revamp the habits of your mind and redirect your course towards prosperity. Adopt as a part of your definite chief aim the habit of saving a regular proportion of your income, even if this be more than a penny a day. Very soon, this habit will begin to lay hold of your mind, and you will actually get joy out of saving. Any habit may be discontinued by building in its place some other and more desirable habit. The spending habit must be replaced by the saving habit by all who attain financial independence. Merely to discontinue an undesirable habit is not enough, as such habits have a tendency to reappear unless the place they formerly occupied in the mind is filled by some other habit of a different nature. The discontinuance of a habit leaves a hole in the mind, and this hole must be filled up with some other form of habit, or the old one will return and claim its place. Throughout this course, many psychological formulas, which the student has been requested to memorize and practice, have been described. You will find such a formula in Lesson 3, the object of which is to develop self-confidence. These formulas may be assimilated so they become a part of your mental machinery through the law of habit, if you will follow the instructions for their use which accompany each of them. It is assumed that you are striving to attain financial independence. The accumulation of money is not difficult after you have once mastered the fear of poverty and developed in its place the habit of saving. The author of this course would be greatly disappointed to know that any student of the course got the impression from anything in this or any of the other lessons that success is measured by dollars alone. However, money does represent an important factor in success, and it must be given its proper value in any philosophy intended to help people in becoming useful, happy, and prosperous. The cold, cruel, relentless truth is that in this age of materialism, a man is no more than so many grains of sand, which may be blown helter-skelter by every stray wind of circumstance, unless he is entrenched behind the power of money. Genius may offer many rewards to those who possess it, but the fact still remains that genius without money, with which to give it expression, is but an empty, skeleton-like honor. The man without money is at the mercy of the man who has it. And this goes regardless of the amount of ability he may possess, the training he has had, or the native genius with which he is gifted by nature. There is no escape from the fact that people will weigh you very largely in the light of bank balances, no matter who you are or what you can do. The first question that arises in the minds of most people when they meet a stranger is, how much money has he? If he has money, he is welcomed into homes and business opportunities are thrown his way. All sorts of attention are lavished upon him. He is a prince, and as such is entitled to the best of the land. But if his shoes are run down at the heels, his clothes are not pressed, his collar is dirty, and he shows plainly the signs of impoverished finances, woe be his lot. For the passing crowd will step on his toes and blow the smoke of disrespect in his face. These are not pretty statements, but they have one virtue. They are true. This tendency to judge people by the money they have, or their power to control money, is not confined to any one class of people. We all have a touch of it, whether we recognize the fact or not. Thomas Edison is one of the best known and most respected inventors in the world, yet it is no misstatement of fact to say that he would have remained a practically unknown, obscure personage had he not followed the habit of conserving his resources and shown his ability to save money. Henry Ford never would have got to first base with his horseless carriage had he not developed quite early in life the habit of saving. Moreover, had Mr. Ford not conserved his resources and hedged himself beyond their power, he would have been swallowed up by his competitors or those who covetously desire to take his business away from him long, long years ago. Many a man has gone a very long way toward success only to stumble and fall, never again to rise, because of lack of money in timeless of emergency. The mortality rate in business each year due to lack of reserve capital for emergencies is stupendous. To this one cause are due more of the business failures than to all other causes combined. Reserve funds are essential in the successful operation of business. Likewise, savings accounts are essential to success on the part of individuals. Without a savings fund, the individual suffers in two ways. First, by the inability to seize opportunities that come only to the person with some ready cash, and second, by embarrassment due to some unexpected emergency calling for cash. It might be said also that the individual suffers in still a third respect by not developing the habit of saving. Through lack of certain other qualities essential for success which grow out of the practice of the habit of savings. The nickels, dimes, and pennies which the average person allows to slip through his fingers would, if systematically saved and properly put to work, eventually bring financial independence. Through the courtesy of a prominent building and loan association, the following table has been compiled showing what a monthly saving of $5, $10, $25, or $50 will amount to at the end of 10 years. These figures are startling when one comes to consider the fact that the average person spends from $5 to $50 a month for useless merchandise or so-called entertainment. The making and saving of money is a science, yet the rules by which money is accumulated are so simple that anyone may follow them. The main prerequisite is a willingness to subordinate the present to the future by eliminating unnecessary expenditures for luxuries. A young man who is earning only $20 a week as a chauffeur for a prominent New York banker was induced by his employer to keep an accurate account of every cent he spent for 1 week. The following is an itemized list of his expenses. Cigarettes, chewing gum, soda fountains, cigars, movie shows, shaves, newspapers, shoeshines, board and room, money on hand, $20. These figures tell a tragic story which might as well apply to the thousands of other people as to the young man who kept his account. His actual savings out of the $20 was only 53 cents. He spent $7.47 for items, every one of which could have been greatly reduced, and most of which could have been eliminated entirely. In fact, by shaving himself and shining his own shoes, he could have saved every cent of the $7.50. Now turn to the table made by the Building and Loan Association and observe what the saving of $7.50 a week would amount to. Suppose the amount this man actually saved had been only $25 a month. This saving would have increased to the snug sum of $5,000 by the end of the first 10 years. The young man in question was 21 years old at the time he kept his expense account. By the time he reached the age of 31 years, he could have had a substantial amount in the bank had he saved $25 a month. And this saving would have brought him many opportunities that would have led directly to financial independence. Some who are short-sighted, pseudo-philosophers are fond of pointing to the fact that no one can become rich merely by saving a few dollars a week. This may be true enough as far as the reasoning goes, which is not very far. But the other side of the story is that the savings of even a small sum of money places one in a position where oftentimes this small sum may enable one to take advantage of business opportunities which lead directly and quite rapidly to financial independence. The foregoing table, showing what a savings of $5 a month will amount to at the end of 10 years, should be copied and pasted on your mirror, where it will stare you in the face every morning when you get up and every night as you retire, providing you have not already acquired the habit of systematic savings of money. This table should be reproduced in letters and figures an inch tall and placed on the walls of every public school throughout the land, where it might serve as a constant reminder to all school children of the value of saving money. Some years ago, before giving serious thought to the value of the savings habit, this author made up an account of the money which had slipped through his fingers. The amount was so alarming that it resulted in the writing of this lesson, and adding the habit of savings as one of the 15 laws of success. Following is an itemized statement of the account. Over the period of time, he had spent over $47,000 on extras and sundries. This amount, had it been saved and invested as received in Building and Loan Association, or in some other manner that would have earned compound interest, would have grown into the sum of $94,000 at the time this lesson is being written. The author is not a victim of any of the usual habits of dissipation, such as gambling, drinking, and excessive entertaining. It is almost unbelievable that a man whose habits of living are reasonably moderate could spend $47,000 within a little over 10 years without having anything to show for the money, but it can be done. A capital reserve of $94,000 working at a compound interest is sufficient to give any man all the financial freedom he needs. I recall one occasion when the president of a large corporation sent me a check for $500 for an address I delivered at a banquet given to the employees, and I distinctively recall what went through my mind when I opened the letter and saw the check. I had wanted a new automobile, and this check was exactly the amount required for the first payment. I had it spent before it had been in my hands 30 seconds. Perhaps this is the experience of the majority of people. They think more of how they are going to spend what they have than they do about ways of means of savings. The idea of savings and the self-control and self-sacrifice which must accompany it is always accompanied by thoughts of an unpleasant nature. But oh, how it does thrill one to think of spending. There is a reason for this, and that reason is the fact that most of us have developed the habit of spending while neglecting the habit of saving. And any idea that frequents the human mind but seldom is not as welcome as that which frequents it often. In truth, the habit of saving can be made as fascinating as the habit of spending, but not until it has become a regular, well-grounded, systematic habit. We like to do that which is often repeated, which is but another way of stating what the scientists have discovered, that we are victims of our habits. The habit of saving money requires more force of character than most people have developed, for the reason that saving means self-denial and sacrifice of amusements and pleasure in scores of different ways. For this very reason, one who develops a savings habit acquires, at the same time, many of the other needed habits which lead to success, especially self-control, self-confidence, courage, poise, and freedom from fear. How much would one person save? The first question that will arise is, how much should I save? The answer cannot be given in a few words, for the amount one should save depends upon many conditions, some of which may be within one's control, and some of which may not. Generally speaking, a man who works for salary should apportion his income about as follows. Savings account, 20%. Living, clothes, food and shelter, 50%. Education, 10%. Recreation, 10%. Life insurance, 10%, for a total of 100%. The following, however, indicates the approximate distribution which the average man actually makes of his income. Savings account, nothing. Living, clothes, food and shelter, 60%. Education, 0%. Recreation, 35%. Life insurance, 5%, with a total of 100%. Under the item of recreation is included, of course, many expenditures that do not really recreate, such as money spent for alcoholic drinks, dinner parties, and other similar items which may actually serve to undermine one's health and destroy character. An experienced analyst of men has stated that he could tell very accurately by examining a man's monthly budget what sort of life the man is living. Moreover, that he will get most of his information from the one item of recreation. This, then, is an item to be watched as carefully as the greenhouse keeper watches the thermometer, which controls the life and death of his plants. Those who keep budget accounts often include an item called entertainment, which in a majority of cases turns out to be an evil because it depletes the income heavily, and when carried to excess depletes also the health. We are living right now in an age when the item of entertainment is altogether too high in most budget allowances. Tens of thousands of people who earn not more than $50 a week are spending as much as one-third of their income for what they call entertainment, which comes in a bottle with a questionable label on it at anywhere from $6 to $12 a quart. Not only are these unwise people wasting the money that should go into a savings fund, but of far greater danger, they are destroying both character and health. Nothing in this lesson is intended as a preachment or morality, or on any other subject. We are here dealing with cold facts, which to a large extent constitute the building materials out of which success may be created. However, this is an appropriate place to state some facts, which have such a direct bearing on the subject of achieving success, that they cannot be omitted without weakening this entire course in general, and this lesson in particular. The author of this course is not a reformer, neither is he a preacher on morals, as his field of useful endeavor is quite well covered by others who are able workers. What is here stated, therefore, is intended as a necessary part of the course of philosophy, whose purpose is to mark a safe road over which one may travel to honorable achievement. During the year 1926, the author was in partnership with the late Don R. Mellett, who was at that time the publisher of the Canton Daily News. Mr. Mellett became interested in the law of success philosophy because it offered, as he believed, sound counsel to young men and young women who really wished to get ahead in life. Through the pages of the Daily News, Mr. Mellett was conducting a fierce battle against the underworld forces of Canton. With the aid of detectives and investigators, some of whom were supplied by the governor of Ohio, Mr. Mellett and the author gathered accurate data concerning the way most of the people in Canton were living. In July 1926, Mr. Mellett was assassinated from ambush, and four men, one of them a former member of the Canton Police Force, are now serving life sentences in the Ohio State Penitentiary for the crime. During the investigation into crime conditions in Canton, all reports came to the author's office, and the data here described are therefore known to be absolutely accurate. One of the officials of a large industrial plant, whose salary was $6,000 a year, paid a Canton bootlegger an average of $300 a month for the liquor, if stuff be called liquor, which he used for entertaining. His wife participated in these entertainments, which took place in his own home. A paying teller in a bank, whose salary was $150 a month, was spending on average of $75 a month on liquor. And in addition to this unpardonable waste of money, out of the salary, which is none too great at most, he was traveling at a pace and with a crowd which meant ruin for him later on. The superintendent of a large manufacturing plant, whose salary was $5,000 a year, and should have been able to save at least $125 a month, was actually saving nothing. His bootlegger's bill averaged $150 a month. A policeman whose income was $160 a month was spending over $400 a month on dinner parties at a nearby roadhouse. Where he got the difference between his legitimate income and his actual expenditures is a question that reflects no particular credit on the policeman. A bank official whose income, as near as it could be estimated from his previous year's income tax report, was about $8,000 a year, had a monthly bootlegger bill of more than $500 during the 3 months that his activities were checked by Mellett's investigators. A young man who worked in a department store at a salary of $20 a week was spending on average of $35 a week with one bootlegger. The assumption was that he was stealing the difference from his employer. Old man trouble awaited this young man just around the corner, although it is not known by the author whether or not the two have come together as yet. A salesman for a life insurance company, whose income was not known because he worked on a commission basis, was spending on average of $200 a month with one bootlegger. No record of any savings account was found, and the assumption is that he had none. This assumption was later confirmed when the company for which the young man worked had him arrested for embezzlement of its funds. No doubt he was spending the money which he should have been turned into the company. He is now serving a long sentence in the Ohio State Penitentiary. A young lad who was attending high school was spending large sums for liquor. The actual amount was not obtainable for the reason that he paid cash as he got the liquor, and the bootlegger's records did not therefore disclose the actual amount. Later this boy's parents had him locked up to save him from himself. It was found that he was stealing money from a savings fund kept by his mother, somewhere about the house. He had stolen and spent more than $300 of this money when discovered. This author conducted a lecture bureau in 41 high schools, where he lectured once a month during the entire school season. The principals of these high schools stated that less than 2% of the students showed any tendency towards saving money, and an examination through the aid of a questionnaire prepared for that purpose disclosed the fact that only 5% of the students, out of a total of 11,000 of the high school age, believed that the savings habit was one of the essentials for success. It is no wonder the rich are becoming richer and the poor are becoming poorer. Call this a socialistic statement if you please, but the fact bears out its accuracy. It is not difficult for any man to become rich in a country of spendthrifts such as these, where millions of people spend every cent that comes into their possession. Many years ago, before the present wave of mania for spending spread over the country, F.W. Woolworth devised a very simple method of catching the nickels and dimes that millions of people throw away for trash, and his system netted him over $100 million in a few years' time. Woolworth has died, but his system of saving nickels and dimes continues, and his estate is growing bigger and bigger. 5- and 10-cent stores are usually painted with a bright red font. This is an appropriate color, for red denotes danger. Every 5- and 10-cent store is a striking monument that proves to the nicety that one of the cardinal faults of this generation is the spending habit. We are all victims of habit. Unfortunately for most of us, we are reared by parents who have no conception whatsoever of the psychology of habit. And without being aware of their fault, most parents aid and abet their offsprings in the development of the spending habit by overindulgence with spending money and by lack of training in the habit of saving.